I guess it would actually help if I pressed record. There we go. Okay. So we have four readings this morning, and I'm going to have you guys help out with the readings as usual. They're all fairly short, though. It's a short chapter. So who would like to get verses 1 through 5? 1 through 5? Eric, I saw your hand first. Sorry, Dan. All right, the next reading is super long. It will go to Dale. No, I'm just kidding. Dale, you can have 6 through 11. So it's a passage of similar length. Who would like 12 through 19? Natalie, 12 through 19. And then fourth reading, last reading, 20 to 22. Grace. Okay. All right. That's right. Eric, you want to start us out?
The word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountain, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, "Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths." For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. O house of Jacob, come, and let us walk in the light of the Lord.
For thou hast abandoned thy people, the house of Jacob, because they are filled with influences from the east, and they are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they strike bargains with the children of foreigners. Their land has also been filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land has also been filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land has also been filled with idols. They worship the work of their hands, that with which their fingers have made. So the common man has been humbled, and the man of importance has been abased. But do not forgive them. Enter the rock and hide in the dust, from the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day.
For the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan, upon all the high mountains, and upon all the hills that are lifted up, upon every high tower, and upon every fortified wall, upon all the ships of Tarshish, and upon all the beautiful fleets, the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of man shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day, but the idols he shall utterly abolish. They shall go into the holes of the rocks, and into the caves of the earth, from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty, when he arises to shake the earth mightily.
In that day, a man shall cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they made each one for himself to worship, to the moles and to the bags, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the tops of the ragged rock, for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty, when he arises to shake terribly the earth. Cease ye from man, whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of?
All right. So chapter 1 was the introduction to Isaiah's sort of whole message. And so what we get here at the start of chapter 2, then, after the introductory message, which sort of summarizes, here's all the major themes, or at least most of the major themes, which Isaiah is going to be referencing to in his message. In chapter 2, we get sort of his first, it's almost his first sermon. It's the, maybe not chronologically the first, but certainly the first which he's written down for us. And it starts out by, if there's a key word, if there's a theme word in Isaiah chapter 2, it might be the word day. So if you look, you're going to see references to day and days and different times. It's going to say things like, in the latter days, in the day of the Lord, in those days. And so what you're going to get here in chapter 2, and what we get, is God's dealing with Jerusalem, given to us as a series of days, given to us as a series of future days, days that are present and days that are yet to come, but maybe in the near future. So we're going to start out with Zion in the end of days. Zion in the end of days. And that's going to be point number one. It's there on your handouts if you're using those. And this is verses 1 through 5. Let me just read that again real quick. The word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills. And all the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations. He shall decide for many disputes for many peoples. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. So this is a promise of a day which is yet to come when God's purposes for Zion and God's purposes for Jerusalem and for Judah will be fulfilled. And that is that Zion, that Jerusalem, is going to be the place that all of the nations flow toward. In other words, it's going to be the world's center of political, spiritual, and judicial gravity. Now, this is sort of a funny mental image if you think about what is actually being said. And the translation which I just read, at least in this regard, it says, all the nations shall flow to it, end of verse 2. That's a pretty literal rendering of what it says in Hebrew. It's this idea, if you've seen water flow downhill, as most of us have, that's sort of the natural thing that water does.
Kindly inclining,
that's right, yes, exactly. Water is flowing downhill, it is kindly inclining unto itself. There's another fun phrase about that, water always seeks its level. But if you could imagine for a moment water flowing uphill, that is literally the mental image which the poet, which Isaiah, is trying to create for us here. And that is very difficult to imagine, you know, water flowing uphill. But as I was getting my notes ready this morning, I was thinking about, Spurgeon says, and I suppose he should know, Spurgeon says that all preachers should spend some time every day translating Virgil. Now, the reason he says they should do that is because preachers should know how to say things, not just how to say things, but how to say things well. And that is something which Virgil does very well, and something you can learn from him. So Spurgeon says, if you want to be a preacher or somebody who speaks in public, spend a little time every day translating Virgil. Now, I do not spend every day translating Virgil. I sort of wish that I did. But I have spent a little time with Virgil, and in his Georgics, everybody knows the Aeneid, and you probably did it in school, at least somewhat. The Aeneid is, of course, that's the story of Aeneas, the hero of Troy, who goes and he founds the city which will be the city that founds Rome, essentially. Virgil, before he wrote the Aeneid, wrote two other works. One of them is called the Georgics. And the Georgics is a poetic, how do I explain this? It is a manual for farmers. It's how to be a farmer in ancient Rome. But the funny thing is Virgil was not a farmer himself at all. But he thought that this sort of work would be a good sort of work to write a lot of nature poetry, and it was, and it is. And so what he did is he went and looked at some Greek poets and the poetry that they wrote about farming, and he sort of imitated it and improved upon it. And in the final book of the Georgics, book 4, he talks about bees. It's all about beekeeping and how to keep bees, and it's very interesting stuff. But the right towards the very end, when he speaks of all of the bees returning home to their hives, he speaks of them as a tide of water which is flowing upward towards their hive. And again, it's this idea of water in a group sort of all flowing upward. It's difficult to imagine the nations of the world as water flowing upward. Maybe it's not. Maybe you've got good imaginations. But when you start thinking about this analogy of bees, this really helps me. And I'm not saying Isaiah read Virgil, obviously. And I don't even think Virgil read Isaiah. But it's this sort of similar poetic imagery. And if you can sort of think of the nations of the world as swarms of bees returning home to their hives, I think it's a pretty good sense of what Isaiah is trying to say here. He's saying, in the last days, in the latter days, at the end of days, Jerusalem is going to become the center of gravity for all the nations of the world, and they are going to flow there. They're going to swarm there like bees returning to their home. So, first of all, he says it's going to be the political center of the world, and that's in verse 2. And I think there's an implicit contrast here with the actual political centers of the world at the time. The actual political centers of the world at the time are Assyria and Egypt. Those are the two great political powers when Isaiah is writing. And Assyria and Egypt are about to duke it out, and Assyria is going to win. But those are the two main political centers of gravity, and interestingly enough, Judah is situated about halfway between those two. Not quite halfway, but pretty much. And so here is Judah. They are caught, as Isaiah is penning these words, they are caught in this power struggle between the gravitational pulls of Assyria, based out of Nineveh, and in Egypt. And they're being pulled in these two different directions. And Isaiah is saying there's coming a day when the nations of the world will not struggle, they won't fight over Jerusalem, but they will instead flow towards it like bees returning to their hive. It'll be the political center of the world. Zion will also be the spiritual center of the world in verse 3. It says, many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So here, Zion, the mountain of the Lord, upon which the temple stands, and upon which God has chosen to, in the poetic idiom of the Old Testament, chosen to dwell. And it's not... And the Bible is fairly clear about this. It's not that God can be contained in one place or that he only dwells in one place, but he has come, you know, to put his presence in a very special way in the temple in Jerusalem at this time. And so the mountain of the Lord, it says, is going to be the place where all people of the world will turn to, not just for political leadership, but for spiritual instruction. And I think, again, there's a very implicit contrast here between the mountain of the Lord, between Mount Zion, upon which the temple stands, and all of the other mountains of the heathen world. So, in heathenism, it is very, very frequent. In fact, I hesitate to say universal, because there are, of course, places that don't have mountains. But I would say it is nearly universal that heathen cultures all over the world at various different times and places have all placed certain spiritual significance in high mountains and hills. And they've conducted worship in these things. Obviously, the Old Testament talks quite a bit about the high places. Can you guys think of, outside of the Bible, can you guys think of some spiritually significant mountains for different heathen cultures? So in Rome, it's still there today. You can go and see it. In Rome, the most important hill in Rome is the Capitoline Hill, from which we get our word capital. And on the Capitoline Hill, there's an enormous temple to the Roman gods. This is the most important center, one of the most important centers of worship in the classical world. Of course, that's a fair amount of time after Isaiah. Can you guys think of another giant mountain that's maybe associated with the pantheon? Mecca is not on a mountain. It's a city. The Acropolis in, of course... I mean, obviously, every town in Greece had an Acropolis, but the Acropolis is in Athens, and of course, there's a big temple up there as well. So, yes.
Mount Olympus?
There we go. I was waiting for Olympus. I was waiting for somebody to be like, what about Olympus? Olympus is a real mountain, you guys. It's not just like, you know, the Greeks are talking about, you know, Mount Olympus, and it's like some figurative place. Mount Olympus is a real mountain, all right? And it is one of two mountains upon which... The Greek poets sort of figuratively invested with their gods. Do you guys remember the other mountain?
Etna?
What's that?
Etna?
Ida.
Oh, I was thinking
Oh, yeah. No, well, it's Mount Ida. Mount Olympus and Mount Ida. These are the two mountains which are very, and they're actually two Mount Idas, so that's confusing. And they're both important, so that's also confusing. But Mount Ida, Mount Olympus, these are the two important mountains of the Greek pantheon. In some of the religions in the Indian subcontinent, there's a mountain called Meru Peak, which is very, very significant. It's very important. In modern-day Turkey, there is a mountain that used to be called Zafon. I think it is called, I'm going to say this wrong, but Jebel Akra in modern-day Turkey. And it was a very important mountain in the Hittite religion, which would have been about cognate with this time. Now, there's another mountain. There are two other mountains that are very religiously significant in the part of the world where Isaiah is writing to. One of them, you'll remember from the story of Elijah, is Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel, and we talked about this in our Divided Kingdom study, but that was like 6 years ago, so I don't expect any of you to remember it. But Mount Carmel in the ancient world, in fact, all the way up till the time of Christ, was a mountain that was invested with great religious significance by many different pagan cultures, by the Canaanite pagan cultures. Even the Romans, though, invested it with a certain amount of significance. There's a reason that the showdown between Baal and Yahweh takes place on Mount Carmel, because Mount Carmel is an extremely sacred place to the Baalist religion. So there's Mount Carmel, which is one of the chief high places of that whole region. But I think also, speaking now under the New Covenant, that we can kind of think about Mount Sinai in relation to these things as well. That Mount Sinai is the place where the law is given. It's the place where the old covenant with Israel is given. Speaking today under a new covenant, which is not just a covenant with Israel, but it is a covenant which is now open to all mankind, is no longer exclusive. We can say that the worship of Jesus Christ, the worship of the true Messiah, is something which overtops even Sinai, even the giving of the law, which Christ fulfills in himself. So Zion is going to be the spiritual center of the world. Zion is also going to be the judicial center of the world. This is in verse 4. He will judge between the nations and shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. There will no longer be, in the day that Isaiah is speaking of, and the day of which he prophesies, there will no longer be need for war, or even a need for the learning of war, even the need for the preparation of war, because God himself will dispense perfect justice to the nations. Now, all of these things, we are told, take place in the last days. And the Hebrew word here that is used for last days can refer to something which is either temporally, so in terms of time, a very long way away, but it can also refer to something which is spatially distant. So in the Psalms, when you will come across a phrase in some of the Psalms, I can't remember which ones now, but you'll come across this phrase, and it'll say something like the ends of the earth, or sometimes the far reaches, or the end of the sea. And that's actually the same word that is used for last days here. The idea is it is something that is at the end of everything. It's at the final culmination of a process or a journey. And what Isaiah is telling us here is that this time he is speaking of comes as the culmination of a long process. And that process is, I think, God's salvation work, his salvific work for his people, and indeed for all of mankind. So the time that Isaiah is looking forward to, I think we could all look at this and say that in most respects, this time has not yet come true. Now, all nations of the world may be looking at Jerusalem, but Jerusalem is not the political center of gravity in the world. That's probably where we live. We certainly have not beat our swords into plowshares yet. In fact, I think just this last week, the United States fired off one of their ICBMs just to remind people that, hey, we can still nuke you from the other side of the planet. So that's nice. It's good to, yeah. I'm so glad that we learn lessons as human beings, you know, and that we don't keep repeating the mistakes of the past. That's wonderful. The time that the time that Isaiah is speaking about, it was in the distant future for Judah and Jerusalem. But it is still in the future, and I don't know how distant, for you and me. Back at Babel, remember we talked about Babel back in the very first week. Back at Babel, the city of confusion, mankind was dispersed. What Isaiah is saying is that in Jerusalem, the city of peace, mankind will be reunited. The future which he is promising here and which he is predicting here is nothing less than the healing of the curse of Babel. And this is a curse which I do believe God has already begun to heal, as he has all other curses, with his work on the cross and with the church age. Only in the church age do we see this prophecy beginning to come true. I'm certainly not saying it has been fulfilled, and I'm not even saying it'll be fulfilled anytime soon. That's more than I have wisdom to say. But if you remember back to the book of Acts, what's the first big event that happens in the book of Acts? It's Pentecost, right? What happens at Pentecost? All the nations of the world, people from all nations of the world, flow to Jerusalem for this festival. And at the Feast of Pentecost, Peter and the other disciples, as they get up to preach, they begin to preach. And as they preach, everyone hears them in their own tongues. Now, that is like, and it is different from, what we have before Babel. What we have before the curse of Babel is perfect communication. We all speak the same language, and language is culture, and culture is language. So if we all speak the same language, what that also means is that we all share the same culture. And so mankind is perfectly united. Doesn't mean there aren't problems between individuals, but there's not the sense of you've got different races or different ethnicities or different nationalistic movements and they're all opposed to each other. And then Curse of Babel comes and people split off, mankind splits off into families and tribes and nations. And that's how human history sort of begins. But at Pentecost, all the individualism of those languages and those cultures, those are not erased. People don't stop being, you know, Egyptian at Pentecost. People don't stop being Syrian at Pentecost. People don't stop being Roman at Pentecost. But what happens is that as Peter is preaching, everyone hears his preaching in their own native tongue. Unity is accomplished once again, but individuality is not destroyed. And that is, in the same way that what we get in Christ is better than what we lost in Adam, what we get in the church is better than what we lost at Babel. And so I do think the curse of Babel is beginning to unravel. It is beginning to be rolled back, but it is just the first thaw of spring, and it's going to be, I think, a long time coming. The state where all nations will turn forever towards Christ as their king is still in the future, even for us. Now, in verse 5, we get a connecting statement. In verse 5, we get a connecting statement. And that is, after the vision forward, the vision of days to come, we are brought back to the present by Isaiah. And this helps us understand some of God's long-term plan. Dealing with Judah's sin now, so that someday they will be able to fulfill all of God's purposes. And many people have talked, and I think it's definitely something which is worth considering for us today, about Israel's unique placement in the ancient world, that they are placed right at the crossroads of commerce and trade in what was then the civilized world. And it was always God's design that Israel should be a missionary people. This is why God, when God establishes the nation of Israel, he says, I want you to be a nation of priests. Now, here's the thing. If you have an entire nation of priests need people to minister to that are not other priests. So if you have an entire nation of priests, what are you supposed to be doing? You're supposed to be going and doing priest things for all of the other nations. But then right there at the beginning, Israel turns away from God, and only the tribe of Levi is clean enough and pure enough to take up that priestly role. And they have to now minister to their own Israelite brothers who should have been priests. Incidentally, what does John say in Revelation about the church? That he has made us priests and kings unto God and our Father. We are a nation of priests. We are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, Peter says, called out of darkness into light. Why? Yes, to minister to each other, for sure. But we are called with a missionary purpose to minister for it and to intercede for it, to pray for it, and to sacrifice ourselves for the nations. This is God's purpose for Judah, but in order for them to be able to fulfill their missionary purpose, God has to first deal with their sin. And so by showing us a vision of the far future, of this is what it's going to be like when all of God's salvation work, all of his redemptive plan is complete. And then in verse 5, we get this transition verse, which brings us back to the present. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. And this takes us on to point number 2, which is Zion in the present day. Zion in the present day. Because in direct contrast to the vision of the ideal eschatological future, the future at the end of things, Isaiah zooms back to the current state of affairs. And he says this is one in which God has rejected the house of Jacob because of their sin. Let me just read verses 6 through 11 real quick. For you have rejected your people, the house of Jacob, because they are full of things from the east and of fortune tellers like the Philistines, and they strike hands with the children of foreigners. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. The land is filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their own hands, to what their own fingers have made. So man is humbled, and each one is brought low. Do not forgive them. Enter into the rock. Hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord, and from the splendor of his majesty. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the lofty pride of men shall be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. Zion in the present day. So Isaiah then begins with a list of Israel's specific sins, the things of which they are full. And he starts out by saying they're full of things, and I think maybe Dale's translation said full of influences, but they're full of things or full of influences from the east. Now, this fullness refers to the idea, it's a metaphor, and it refers to the idea of a cup which is so full of one thing that it cannot be filled with another. And I think the picture is pretty clear. Judah has spent so much time filling herself with the pleasures and the sophistication of the pagan cultures around them. And when it says the east, I think specifically Nineveh and Babylon. Babylon, even long before Isaiah's time, was a cultural center of the world. It was, in fact, who was this? It might be Herodotus. One of the very, very early Greek historians writes about Babylon, and he says of them, this is sometime after Isaiah, but he says of them, he writes at great length describing the museums of Babylon. Because Babylon is a city so old that their own history in their own minds is ancient. Now, when we say ancient history, we really mean a period that's, 4,000 years, maybe longer. Like, we just sort of lump all these things together in ancient history, but you have to think that even people in what we would consider ancient history studied ancient history. And they had museums where you could go to, and you could be like, oh, yes, that's the coinage from Hasharbana, the fourth, from 1,000 years ago. And, like, Babylon was this huge cultural center. As a rule, when foreign governments and armies would take over Babylon, the leaders would try very hard to keep them from sacking the town and destroying it, because there's a lot of valuable stuff in Babylon. Now, Babylon is not, at this point, the tremendous military power that it's going to be by the end of Isaiah, but it's this huge cultural center. And so when he's talking about the east, he's talking about Nineveh, the center of the Assyrian Empire. He's talking about Babylon, which is this, the cultural center of the day. And he's saying, you have absorbed so much, you filled up your cup with so much of their culture that you have no room in it for God. Fortune tellers like the Philistines, verse 6. He's saying that from her pagan neighbors, Judah has picked up the habit of fortune-telling and the use of divination. And when you read about condemnations about magic in Scripture, that there are a couple of different Hebrew words for magic, but the main one which is used, I think it's like 90% of the time, it's a really significant amount of the time. The main form of magic, which in the Old Testament context is the practices of these non-Yahwehist religions, is divination. It is trying to see the future through spiritual means. It's trying to, the way that they typically did this is they would take an animal and they would sacrifice this animal to the gods, and then they would cut it open. And depending on the kind of thing you're trying to divine, they would either pull out its liver or they would pull out its intestines. And they would stick them down there on the altar, and then they would study them. And they would say, well, if this part of the liver is swollen, or it's this color, or it's this shape, or if the intestines fall in a shape that, you know, roughly resembles a U.S. president or something like that, that was not intended to be anything against U.S. presidents. I was just trying to think of somebody famous. But that, you know, if you do these things, this will answer your question. It will tell you whether or not you should go and do such a thing. If you want to know if your business venture is going to be successful, if you want to know, should I march my army against this city or against this city? If you want to know, who should be the next king? If you want to know, are the gods going to bless the crops this year? All of these different things to know what's going to happen in the future. These are things that we practice divination for. And in many of these cultures, they would do divination for the smallest things. And for many of these cultures, divination was a great way for those who were in power to control those who were not. If you're the guy who's in charge of saying whether or not the liver is favorable to whatever enterprise the king wants to do, you have a lot of say. You have a lot of power. You can be like, I don't think the liver looks good today, king. Look at this liver. And the king's going to be like, yeah, that doesn't know. I'll take your word for it. It's all right. Divination. And what Isaiah is saying is that Israel and Judah have picked up from their foreign neighbors the habit of using divination to try to know the future instead of trusting in God. Now, divination is, you know, it's easy for us to be super down on, you know, say, well, you know, we're not going to let our kids read Harry Potter or whatever. But then we go and we read books that are about, you know, knowing the will of God as though what is going to happen in the future is something which we can just know. It's something which God will just tell us. And if we read the book right, or we do the numerology, or we find the passages in the Bible or whatever else, that we can really know what the outcome is going to be. We can really know, you know, what is. It is important to know the will of God, all right? But the will of God is plainly revealed in His Word. What is God's will? That we should love one another. What is God's will? That we should fear God, we should honor the king, we should pray for our leaders. What is God's will? That we should obey His commandments. When we talk about knowing, when the Bible talks about knowing the will of God, that is what it is talking about. Usually when we talk about knowing the will of God, it ends up to be a little more like divination. Now, curiously, in the Old Testament, God sometimes gives people these answers. Gideon says, hey God, I'm going to put a fleece out on the ground. Okay? The priest had something they could do with the Urim and the Thummim and the breastplate, and nobody's quite sure what it meant, but we have a pretty good guess, and it's sort of like casting of lots to determine the future. And the disciples cast lots to determine Judas's replacement. So I am not trying to say we should not ask God for clear leading about specific decisions, okay? That's not what I'm saying. Because I think there is a good precedent for that in Scripture. But I think a lot of us, and you get this when, you know, some people, when they study eschatology and they study prophecies and the latter days and things like this, what they're not really wanting is to know, how can I act in a way that will please God? What they're really wanting to know is what is going to happen. In other words, can I get some guarantees that the thing I want to do will be successful? And there's a lot of people in America today who call themselves Christians who will listen to whatever teachers and will read whatever books will tell them, yes, the thing that you want, God is in that, and God is going to bless it, and God is going to make that successful. So we need to be very, very careful about people and things who make those promises to us. They strike hands with the children of foreigners. Judah is entering into business relationships and alliances with the pagan cultures around them. Now, these relationships, I think, in another context, might not be of themselves inherently sinful on their own, but the problem is that they have facilitated Judah's sort of gradual conformity, their syncretism with the cultures around them. And Judah has come to rely on those relationships and rely on those alliances more than they rely on God. There are two major examples of this, which we'll get to in our study of Isaiah. One is Ahaz's disastrous alliance with Assyria, and the other is Hezekiah's equally disastrous alliance with Egypt against Assyria. And it says, their land is filled with silver and gold. Their land is filled with horses. The multiplying of silver and gold and horses and chariots by the kings of Israel is something which God expressly warned against and expressly forbade in the law. Let me just read this to you from Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 17, by the way, is a really great, if you just need a text to show, here is all the ways that Israel just messed up. Like, you can read all the things that God said, don't do these in Deuteronomy 17, and then you can go look at Kings and Chronicles and just sort of check the boxes as you go. Sort of like, oh, Solomon, don't multiply wives, check, silver, gold, check, alliances with Egypt, check, horses and chariots, check. Come on, Solomon, are you reading the book? I mean, it's right in here. When you come into the land that the Lord your God has given you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me, which is exactly what Israel does in 1 Samuel, you may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Okay. He may not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire more horses. In other words, don't make an alliance with Egypt for military strength, which Hezekiah will do, and which Solomon did do. He married Pharaoh's daughter so that he could have an alliance with her, with Egypt. Since the Lord your God has said to you, you shall never turn that way again, he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. Here's all these things which God has said, don't do this, kings of Israel. What do the kings of Israel do? Everything in that list. And that's how they start going bad. David starts out by, doesn't do those other things, but he does multiply wives to himself. And that's kind of a problem for him and his family. Solomon really multiplies wives, and he does all of the other things. And so God divides a kingdom. And it just goes from there. Now, why might excessive wealth and military power be something which God warns a nation against? Any ideas on that?
Because you start trusting in your stuff.
Right, because you start trusting in your chariots and in your horses and in your hoarded gold and silver more than you trust in God. Now, what does that say about our preoccupation in our political situation, our geopolitical environment today? What does it say about our preoccupation with military power and economic might? Right? And in fact, we get like really worried. Oh no, they're downsizing the military. Oh no, the economy's in the tank. Like, we freak out. Those are things that we get anxious about. Maybe some humbling would be good for us. I'm not expressing a political opinion here, but what I'm saying is maybe some humbling would be good for us as a people. Maybe it'd be good for our hearts. It might not be good for our bank accounts, and it might be rough on some other parts of the world, but maybe it would be good for some men's souls to be humbled in that way. Their land is filled with idols, and they bow down to the work of their hands. Now here, for the very first time, Isaiah introduces what is, and it's the only major theme that's not introduced in chapter 1, and it is a major theme of what's going to be a major theme for the rest of the book. And it is the folly of idolatry. In a ghastly contrast to the vision of Jerusalem as a place where the nations of the world will come for spiritual instruction, Judah has taken to herself the idolatrous practices of the surrounding nations. And what I don't want you to do is hear about Judah and Israel's idolatry and imagine for yourself like Greek and Roman statues. Okay? When you see pictures, even today, of Greek and Roman statues, they are almost photorealistic in just the level of detail and art that has gone into them. The thing about all of those statues that have survived to this day is that most of them are made after a time when people believed in the Roman gods as actual gods. So during sort of the late classical age going into the Christian era, the Greeks and the Romans stopped believing in the actual gods as anything other than poetic metaphors for the Logos, for the one true God. And they didn't know who the one true God was. But this is what Paul is preaching against in Athens. He's saying, you have all these gods, but there's an unknown God. There's a one true God who you don't know, but you sacrifice to anyway, and that's what I'm here to tell you about today. And so starting really with Aristotle, they started saying, hey, for God to be good, he has to be perfect, and for something to be perfect, there can't be two of it. That's we talked about that some in John, in our John study, and that's more than I have time to explain this morning. But it's basically this idea that for something to be perfect, it has to be self-sufficient, and for something to be self-sufficient, there can't be two of it, so there has to only be one God. So then, well, what about all of these other gods? Well, maybe they're just poetic metaphors which are supposed to tell us about certain aspects of the true God, whoever that is. And that develops into a culture which is ripe, which is ready for monotheism, and a culture which is ready for the cross and ready for the message. And it's one of the reasons that Christianity spread so easily and so rapidly throughout the Roman world. Now, when you imagine the idols which they're making for themselves, I don't want you to imagine some guy is chiseling out Athena out of marble and it's really pretty, and people are like, whoa, that looks so good, that has such good art, I'm going to worship that. Because people don't worship really good art. Like, they're able to make really good art about these things because they stop worshiping them and they become merely artistic. The stuff that they made looked more like this. So this is from a little bit before the time of Isaiah by a couple of hundred years, but the style didn't really change a lot, so this is a good sample. This is... they just recently unearthed this in Mesopotamia, so I saw it come across my field of interest, and I was like, oh, I'll print that up and bring that on Sunday. I'm going to pass this around if you want to look more closely at it, but this is the Baalish, this is the Canaanite pantheon, looking down upon the world where there's water and land. And I will let you try to figure out which part is which. You can pass that around. That is what people were making with their hands. They weren't making these beautiful, elaborate idols of gold and silver. They're going home and baking clay and carving or taking wood, and they're just carving it into amulets and into tablets and to really crude-looking little idols of the sort which they still unearth. And they're taking those things and they're putting them on a shelf in their house and they're worshiping them. And Isaiah says, how foolish is this that you are taking something which you have made with your own hands and you are calling it God? You are worshiping it. The folly of idolatry. The Old Testament law contains very strong warnings against idolatry, and specifically taking on the gods of other lands. Let me read this to you. This is from Exodus, I think it's chapter 34. Observe what I command to you this day. Behold, I will drive out before you the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Take care lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you go, lest it become a snare in your midst. You shall tear down their altars and break their pillars and cut down their ashram. An ashram is a sacred pole. For you shall worship no other god. For the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land. And when they whore after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and you are invited, you eat of his sacrifice. And you take of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons to whore after their gods. This is very, very strong warnings. Back at the founding, this is when Moses receives the law a second time, when he carves out two tablets to replace the ones that he broke, and he takes them up the mountain, and he receives the law from God a second time. God says, when you enter the land, don't do this. And what we see is that over time, gradually, Israel had started synchronizing their worship. And this is what the calf worship in the northern kingdom of Israel is about. They started synchronizing their worship of Jehovah with the worship of these idol gods. And they'd taken Jehovah and made him just a part of the Baalist pantheon. And they'd taken the Baalist pantheon and they brought those things into their house. And now, instead of going to this beautiful temple, which Solomon built for them to worship in, they are staying home and they're making their own little gods. And, you know, just, you know, really sad little knick-knack sort of things. And they're taking those and they're worshiping that. And Isaiah says, that is folly. Isaiah prays for them to not be forgiven. Verse 9. In fact, let me just read verse 9 to you. So man is humbled, and each one is brought low. Do not forgive them. And Dale, could you read what the NASB says for that again?
Which verse?
Verse 9.
So the common man has been humbled, and the man of importance has been abased.
Right. That is a better translation than the one that I read to you this morning, because the first word there is Adam. That was out of order. But in Hebrew, it's the first word is Adam, from which, you know, Adam comes. Adam just means man generally, the common man. And then the second word for man, which is used there, which I can't remember, is a word which means a special man, a man who is elevated, a man who is in a position of authority or power. And so what Isaiah is saying is that God, you know, because you are worshiping these idols, what are the consequences? And verse 9 is a transition verse, the way that verse 5 was a transition verse. So verse 9 was a transition verse between the future vision of what Zion will be and can be and the way it is now. This is a transition between the way it is now and the consequences, which we're apparently getting into next week. Be careful you stand lest you fall. That's all I'm going to say about that. Now, verse 9 also introduces... So Isaiah is praying for them not to be forgiven. Why? This word forgiven carries the sense of a canceling out of punishment for or consequences for your action. What Isaiah is praying for is that those punishments won't be canceled. They won't be blotted out. Why? Because Israel needs to come face to face with their sins. Israel needs to feel the consequences of their alienation, their separation from God, so that they will be humbled and truly repent, not just have these consequences wiped away for them. Now, verse 9 also introduces what is called a refrain in poetry. Now, we all know what a refrain is when we sing, you know, it's the chorus of a hymn. Like, we'll sing a verse, and then a refrain, and then a verse, and then a refrain, and a verse, and a refrain. In poetry, a refrain doesn't have to be something that regular, but what it is it's a similar pattern of words which is used over and over again throughout the length of a poem to drive a point home. And there are two refrains in chapter 2, and the first one is introduced here in verse 9. Now, based on our reading of the text, as we all read it together a moment ago, I know you were all paying very close attention, so can you identify what that refrain is? It's there in verse 9. Right, you're exactly right. So the refrain is, so man is humbled, then each one is brought low. So verse 9 is repeated again. It's actually repeated again in verse 11, verse 12, and verse 17. That this refrain of the lowly man, the common man, the ordinary man, and the man of power and wealth and prestige, both of them alike are going to be humbled and brought low. And that refrain repeats itself. And so, with this bridge verse, Isaiah turns his attention from addressing God to addressing mankind. In verse 9, he was addressing God and saying, do not forgive them, because he wants them to feel the consequences of their sin. In verse 10, he's going to address Judah, and he instructs them to hide themselves, not just from God's wrath, which we might expect, but from the splendor of his majesty. Now, I suspect that for most of us, and there's this wonderful moment in C.S. Lewis's Paralandra where he says this, where the character of Lewis himself is confronted with an angel. Nandila with an angel. And he's confronted with this angelic being, and as soon as he is just knock-kneed in terror. And also very uncomfortable. And he says, in that moment, he says, I realized then that I did not like goodness half as much as I would have expected. And I suspect that for most of us, we would not like goodness. To be actually confronted with the pure, unadulterated, radiating goodness from the face of God, I think that would hurt. I think that would be unpleasant. I think that would be uncomfortable. I think most of us, when it comes right down to it, what we want is not goodness, what we want is comfort. And Isaiah is telling Israel, flee from the goodness of God, because it's coming. And in verse 10, we get one more refrain, which for sake of brevity, I will say is repeated. It's this, enter into the rock, hide in the dust. We'll talk more about that phrase next week because it's really interesting. But that's repeated again in verse 19 and then one more time in 21. It also appears in Revelation, so we'll talk about why. It's a really interesting phrase. And so where we will close out our wording is, or our reading this morning, is in verse 11. Says, the haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the lofty pride of men shall be humbled. There's that refrain again. And then he says, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And in verse 11, we get one of those promises in Scripture which nobody claims. You know, the whole name it and claim it thing. This is one of the promises in the book. All of the promises in the book are mine. This one is also yours. There is a day coming when all of your pride and all of my pride, and everything we're proud of, and everything we like about ourselves, and hey, I think I'm a pretty sharp guy, or I've been successful, that all of those things are going to be laid low until they are nothing but dust, and only God will be exalted. And it doesn't matter if you were president, it doesn't matter if you were pope, it doesn't matter if you were a great evangelist, it doesn't matter if you were a garbage man. Every single man, woman, and child who has ever lived will stand shoulder to shoulder and bow the knee before God. And only his head will be raised. That is a promise that this day is coming. It is a day of finality for mankind, but it is also a day which is coming swiftly and shortly for Israel because of God's judgment upon them. That's where we're going to stop this morning. Let's pray. Lord, there is just so much in your word. And it is overwhelming sometimes to think about how little and how petty our concerns and our troubles and our hang-ups are when compared to your goodness and your righteousness and the justice which you live in and which you command us to live out. Lord, I thank you that your justice is great, but your mercy is equally great, and that you have borne the brunt of my judgment upon yourself, so that I can come to you and be humbled, not because I deserved anything, but because you took what you did not deserve. Lord, I pray that you would be with our services this morning, and that if anything comes out of these passages and these verses we've read this morning, anything comes out of the words I have said, it would humble ourselves.